This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hey there, here's another mind-rocking show for you. This week I got hammered by some awful news from some great climate science, so I took my troubles to the University of Ottawa climate scientist Paul Beckwith. We get a cutting-edge education. Then we'll try and heal with real food you can grow yourself. Our guest, Caleb Warnock, is a best-selling author. He tells us how humans fed themselves without fossil fuels for centuries. We hear how you can grow food year-round, including during cold winters and summers made hotter by global warming. Take the green way out with Radio EcoShock. We read relentless headlines about our planet heading out of control. Most of them seem to cruise by without hurting us too deeply. Yeah, half the mammals will be extinct soon. The oceans are dying. Scientists declare Earth a toxic planet. Wait, did somebody say it's going to be too hot to hold outdoor music festivals? That's terrible. I love those. My theory is that we all have triggers and breaking points, especially when it comes to climate change news. A couple of mine arrived this week. Now I'm freaked out again. And that means it's time to call our Radio EcoShock regular correspondent, University of Ottawa scientist Paul Beckwith. Paul teaches climate science at the university. He also teaches it to the world via his many YouTube videos. Paul Beckwith, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
You bet. Well, you know, no doubt we're all going to need a climate helpline pretty soon. When we get worried, we'll call up and get a climate counselor. How about you, Paul? Do you get freaked out by climate news sometimes?
I do from time to time, but I try to compartmentalize. And although, you know, I do spend a lot of time, you know, reading papers and doing research on all of the changes that are happening. So, you know, I have to make sure I take breaks from it, you know, take a few days off from time to time. No social media, no work, you know, go to a bunch of movies, spend time with the family and kids, you know, go somewhere, do sort of everyday stuff. But yeah, it does get to you. But I think, you know, I've been doing it for long enough now. I've kind of figured out how to sort of keep it not from affecting me personally too deeply or emotionally or anything like that.
Well, there have been recent studies showing more and more people are feeling climate stress, and we don't need science to watch this all happening literally in our backyards. For example, Paul, in this year of 2017, the city of Chicago had no snow in January and February. That's got to be pretty crazy for people who know Great Lakes winters. What was your experience like this winter, Paul?
Well, in Ottawa, yeah, it started off, we had a very warm fall, late fall, and then, you know, then we got quite a bit of snow, you know, it got a bit colder, but then, you know, it goes through these cycles, then it gets very warm for a while, and then it gets very cold for a while, and then it gets very warm, so it's as the jet streams kind of sweep by, you know, if we're in the trough of the jet stream, then it's warmer than normal, and it could be, you know, 10 degrees Celsius or so. And then as the jet stream passes us and we come into the trough, then we're exposed to the cold Arctic air. And, you know, then it gets quite cold. And, you know, there's been many times this winter when it's been colder in southerly locations like Ottawa as compared to the Arctic, you know, the North Pole. I mean, the Arctic is unbelievable how warm it's been this year. And the failure of the sea ice to form properly is being watched very closely, you know, and it's in the mainstream news stories and things like that as well.
Yes, indeed. When I look at the climate maps on places like climatereanalyzer.org, I see that there's a big red blotch of much warmer than normal up in the Arctic. And then there's actually a bluer section where I live on the western side of the continent saying it's a little colder than expected. So it almost seems like the heat went up there, and it's very unusual here, as you say, with the jet stream waggling around. Well, okay, here's my first personal trigger. I'm minding my own business, Paul. I'm cruising through gardening videos, and a listener sends me a story by journalist Nafiz Ahmed. He says new science suggests we could experience a burst of warming within the next 5 years. Now, I've had problems getting my usual garden plants to survive the strange hot May and June we had last year. The U.S. National Weather Service says this coming spring will be even hotter. It's going to be a struggle to garden. What do you think, Paul? Could we see an even worse jolt in heating, something maybe we haven't seen before, within the next 5 years?
Yes, I think it's very possible. In fact, you know, it's more than possible. It could even be likely. I mean, there's this index. It falls under the category of teleconnections indices. It's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And basically, when it's in the positive phase, then a lot more heat is going into the atmosphere than in the oceans. And when it's in a negative phase, more heat is being stored in the ocean. So the so-called, you know, hiatus or stall in atmospheric temperature rise around the time of the late 90s with the very powerful El Nino that year, making it an exceptionally hot year that year. But for a while since then, more heat's been going into the ocean than in the atmosphere. So the atmospheric temperatures were rising about 0.1 degree per decade for that period of time, when normally they'd be about 0.15. And what we've seen recently is they increased to 0.2 per decade. And then if you look at just the last several years, we've had a 0.2 degree Celsius increase. So the latest numbers are that we're 1.25 degrees Celsius above the 1880 to 1910 or 1920 average. Now, in order to compare to the pre-industrial, which is 1750, you have to add another 0.3 degrees. So that gives you 1.25 plus 0.3 or 1.55 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial. And that was for the year 2016. So we're already above that 1.5 degree benchmark aspiration from the Paris Climate Agreement. And we're very rapidly approaching that 2 degrees Celsius. So if we continue to get rises of 0.2 degrees globally every few years, if that trend continues, clearly we'll be passing the 2-degree mark within 5 years if that trend was to continue. It looks like part of the reason for the large increase of 0.2 degrees in the last 2 years, you know, a big part of that reason was the very powerful El Nino that we had. And then we went into a La Nina, a bit cooler period, but that fizzled out very quickly. And the word is that we're moving back into another El Nino. So even the El Nino, La Nina cycles, which are, you know, they're from 2 to 7 years, they're a bit irregular. They seem to be leaning towards more powerful El Ninos, which are the warming part of the cycle versus the cooling part of the cycle, the La Nina. So, you know, it's certainly very possible that we can get this warming period. The PDO looks like it's shifting to give more air to the atmosphere. And this paper you're talking about was talking about the number of Hiroshima atomic bombs per second that were heating the ocean.
Wow.
Yes, if we want to use that type of metric, Hiroshima bombs per second, you know, a couple of decades ago, the warming in the oceans was about 2 bombs per second. And then in the last 17 years, it's doubled to about 4 bombs per second. In 2013, it tripled again, so that would be 12 Hiroshima bombs per second warming the oceans. The warming, everything seems to be accelerating rapidly in a highly nonlinear exponential fashion with climate change. Whether you look at temperatures, global temperature warming, which we're talking about, if you look at greenhouse gas levels, the CO2 levels, you know, are regularly going up over 3 parts per million each year. And this is, as the International Energy Agency is saying, that our human anthropogenic emissions are somewhat stabilized, yet they're still, if the atmospheric levels are still going up, then that means that we're losing the sinks of CO2 on the planet, like the Amazon rainforest, boreal forests, et cetera. Phytoplankton are getting weaker, and the sources of CO2 from either permafrost and deep sea sediments, et cetera, are increasing, and that also includes, you know, methane as well. So we're in an emergency situation. Our climate is screaming at us, hey, humans, wake up. We have an emergency situation on our hands, and we need to take proportionate response to try to step back from the precipice. In fact, we've already gone over the precipice, and we're falling rapidly. So we need to be caught, arrested, and pulled back from the precipice. You know, we're certainly in this emergency situation. And this is why, you know, years ago, I was completely against things like, well, things falling under the umbrella of, quote, geoengineering. Carbon dioxide removal, not so much, but solar radiation management, yes. And this is why I've been pushing for this three-legged bar stool approach to dealing with our emergency situation.
Okay, now, so listeners can track this. The paper stimulating Ahmed's article, advice.com, was published back in 2015 with the title, Quantifying the Likelihood of a Continued Hiatus in Global Warming. And I'll put links to that in my blog at ecoshock.org. And I want to say, though, Paul, I began by moaning about personal triggers where the news gets too real. And judging by a recent video of yours, I'm thinking you hit one, too. And I'm talking about stories that billionaires expect to get away from climate collapse by building bunkers in the Southern Hemisphere in places like New Zealand. Maybe we'll all head to New Zealand. What's wrong with that logic?
The problem is that the extreme weather events in the Southern Hemisphere are just as bad, just as extreme as extreme weather events in the Northern Hemisphere, because we have a climate system. So, you know, some of these billionaires, they think, okay, well, we're losing the ice that's causing the disruption in, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, we're losing the Arctic ice. So move to the Southern Hemisphere where the temperatures, you know, will be moderated somewhat by ocean temperatures and things like that. But the problem is the climate system is connected and they're just as much a part of it as us and will be affected just as much. Because as we lose Arctic sea ice and snow cover, the Arctic gets a lot darker, absorbs a lot more heat. So there's less heat moving from the equator to the Arctic. So the jet streams slow down and become wavier, and we get all these extreme weather events in the Northern Hemisphere. But because there's more heat at the equator, a lot of that heat goes into more evaporation of the water. So there's more clouds and more water vapor and more storms in the equator. But the heat also rises. And if you reach that wet bulb temperature of 35 degrees, then parts of the land surface become uninhabitable to humans. But that heat has to also go to the Southern Hemisphere, which it does. And if the equator's hotter, more heat's going to the Southern Hemisphere. It gets down to Australia, New Zealand region, causes very high temperatures there, but it also changes the wind patterns around Antarctica. It changes the sea ice formation around Antarctica, and the warm water, ocean water, is undercutting in Antarctica and melting a lot of ice there. So the problem is as the jet streams around Antarctica become much wavier, as they slow down with the warming of Antarctica, then they will actually reach up to areas like New Zealand and Australia. So there will be a lot more climate variability, weather variability, certainly in New Zealand and Australia as Antarctica warms and loses ice, both on land ice shelves, and sea ice. And we've seen record lows of sea ice in Antarctica this year. I mean, a couple of years ago, we had record highs in the sea ice around Antarctica. So we're getting these large gyrations in Antarctica, which we've been seeing in the Arctic. So we have a connected climate system. That these people would be much better off hiring top PR firms, influencing politicians and government to declare a climate change emergency and get strong action. We're all in this boat together. You know, when the tide comes in, all boats rise. When the tide goes out, all boats fall. So they're just in bigger boats than the rest of us.
They do have some big boats. Some of them have 150-foot, 300-foot yachts, but there is not going to be any safe place to hide. We know that. Now, you raised one of the next topics I wanted to talk to you about, which is survivability at the tropics. I've had scientists on the show saying the tropics won't warm that much. The theory was that Earth had a sort of general thermostat, and the tropics are about as warm as they can get. But now Dr. Matthew Huber and his Climate Dynamics Prediction Laboratory have published a new paper saying there is no global thermostat. The paper, you may not have seen it, just came out March 3rd, 2017 in Science Advances. It says, evidence disproving tropical thermostat theory, global warming can breach limits for life. Now, that's not what you want to hear, can breach limits for life. So they looked at the last great warming event, the Paleo-Eocene Thermal Maximum, the PETM, around 56 million years ago. And quoting from the abstract, it says, global ocean temperatures rapidly warmed by about 5 degrees C. That sounds pretty drastic, and I assume that can't happen anytime soon, but maybe the tropics will warm right out of control.
As you get warming of the surface of the ocean, of course, that water is much lighter. So it becomes very, very highly stratified on the ocean. So you get less mixing. So when we talk about warming of 5 degrees C, I mean, it's quite easy to see that the sea surface temperature can warm significantly. And the more it warms, the lighter it is and the more stratified it is. So this becomes not just an issue of the heat going into the ocean, but it's an issue with the vertical movement of water, so upwelling and downwelling in the ocean, which also depends on water currents and the geometry of coastlines and all these different factors. It also depends, of course, on the salinity of the water. So as we get more meltwater from Greenland, say, from Antarctica, and as that water is heated on the surface, then if there's less mixing, then it takes longer for that water, the fresh water, to be completely mixed to reach that sort of average ocean salinity of 35 parts per thousand or 3.5% of salt content. So there's a lot of different factors into play, but the heat capacity of water is enormous compared to that of air. So this is a concern. I mean, if all that heat that's been going into the oceans over decades, if more of that heat is released to the atmosphere, then that will cause a large jump in temperature. I mean, generally, when we talk about global average temperatures and stuff, we're talking about air temperatures because that's where we experience, right? But we're getting more and more and better data from ocean temperatures through the water column. And we've got these Argo floats and we've got various sensors. So we're getting more data on those sort of profiles, and we're seeing massive shifts in the ocean. And not only that, when there's less mixing, the pH of the ocean can drop significantly on the surface and not be mixed throughout the water column. So ocean acidification is a huge issue, and it's dropping to levels. We've already had declines of about 30% in the last few decades of the pH, so that's an increase in acidity in the ocean. So we're about 8.05, down from 8.2 about three decades ago or so. And when we hit 7.9, 7.8, then we take a big hit on the marine food chain. We're already seeing issues in certain locations where the Arctic Ocean, for example, is becoming much more acidic. And there was a recent paper out about that as well. So like all the physical factors from the planet are screaming at us that we have a climate change emergency. And of course, this leads some people to say, throw up their hands and say, look, there's nothing we can do. I mean, I call it the D&D crowd. We have the deniers. Right. And then deniers, when they say, OK, there's stuff going on, but then we can't do anything about it. And then we have the doomer crowd, right, on the other end of the spectrum saying, you know, we can't do anything about it, you know, and giving ridiculously short timelines for utter catastrophe and extinction and stuff like that. So I did a number of videos to try to point out that, you know, hey, it's not all black and white. There's gray areas in between. Right. The Earth is large. That you don't have a complete collapse simultaneously around the planet. You have different pressures occurring to different countries and different regions of the planet at different rates, depending on their latitude, depending on the resilience of the countries, depending on their level of, you know, what percentage of their income is spent on food, for example. If it's half and food prices double, then your country's finished, right? Right. So, you know, and it ties into migration issues and things. It also ties into countries becoming, you know, the politics going to becoming more protectionist, you know, anti-immigrant sort of thing. I mean, we're seeing it all. It all fits into this big picture. You know, the root cause is this abrupt climate change that we're experiencing.
Yes, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, talking with our regular correspondent, Paul Beckwith. He teaches climate science at the University of Ottawa in Canada. His website is paulbeckwith.net. Well, Paul, I'm lining up another guest that may be closer to your own interests. He's in the Middle East, in Oman, to be exact, and so the connections are a bit dicey. But anyway, their team is exploring whether rocks cast up from the Earth's mantle might be able to absorb a significant portion of our emissions. And apparently the mantle rocks have been out of touch with our atmosphere for so long, these rocks are ready to absorb really big amounts of carbon. Have you heard about that?
I haven't heard about that specific study, but rocks are, during periods in the Earth's past history, when there's a lot of rocks exposed, then those rocks are weathered, and the weathering process absorbs CO2, reduces the CO2 levels in the atmosphere. But generally, this process is a very long time scale process. So can we increase the rate of reaction. So it's a chemical reaction. So higher temperatures, reaction rates increase. As you get larger surface area, the chemical reaction increases. So one of the ideas, for example, with olivine is a mineral in rocks which absorbs lots of CO2. So if you grind it up into a very fine powder, that greatly increases the surface area. And if you put this crushed powder on surfaces, on pathways, you know, on roofs, if you put it in the water, then it absorbs tremendous amounts of CO2. But you, of course, have to look at the whole energy budget of this because it takes a lot of energy to grind up rock. Of course, there was the experiment in Iceland where you inject CO2 deep under the ground, and they found that it would turn into rock very quickly. They thought it would take decades to even centuries, and after a few years, a significant amount of the CO2 seemed to be trapped into rocks that were formed down underneath the ground in these deep mines. So the idea of bringing up rock from deep in the earth is the same sort of idea. It's how do we accelerate the weathering process? And there's a lot of research going into that. This fits under the umbrella of CDR, or carbon dioxide removal. I mean, personally, I think that the best options for carbon dioxide removal are to try to get some balance in the biosphere, because we have actually reduced the biomass on the planet significantly in the last 100, 200 years. And we've obviously gone overboard on animals, and we've degraded plants significantly. So if we could restore some of that balance, you know, for example, we've lost 90% of the large fish in the oceans. If we had that 90% back, that's an enormous amount of carbon that wouldn't be in the atmosphere, wouldn't be in the ocean, making them acidified. If we stimulated phytoplankton growth in massive amounts and then, you know, restored the web, the trophic webs in the ocean, that would be a way to have a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere ocean system. So these are things that we can do. I mean, we can't keep cutting down forests and replacing them with agriculture and things like that. You know, we have to look at these issues. Like, there's no one solution to this, but these things all fall under the umbrella of carbon dioxide removal. It's sort of letting nature do what it normally does and actually enhancing the process and trying to accelerate it, because we are in an emergency situation.
What have you heard lately about the methane situation?
Yeah, methane, the levels are definitely going up in the Arctic regions, especially in regions where there used to be sea ice coverage at least part of the year, and now it's open year-round. I did a series of videos on looking at methods that naturally removed methane. So if methane was coming up from the seafloor, for example, how much methane would be broken down by bacteria, et cetera, microorganisms in the mud, in the sediments itself, how much would go into the water column as bubbles, how much would be broken down in the water column by aerobic respiration in the presence of oxygen, and how much would get into the atmosphere, et cetera. So I did a series of videos on this. So I think the point is if there's very large episodic bursts of methane into the water column, then most of that methane makes it into the atmosphere. If the methane is coming out over vast areas, but, you know, in smaller amounts, sort of trickling out, then there will be a lot less of that methane getting up into the atmosphere in that scenario, because a lot of it will be broken down in the sediment and in the water columns. So it was looking at methane class rates in particular. It wasn't considering the methane on, of course, we know that the methane coming up from the permafrost, you know, is a huge threat. We see lots of slump and these methane holes, sort of the methane craters. You know, we see coastal erosion with the release of methane. We see all of these things happening. So I know there are some very interesting ideas looking at how can we break down methane better once it gets up into the atmosphere. I mean, naturally, the sun shortwave radiation has enough energy to break water molecules apart. It breaks the hydrogen off, so you have the OH minus, and that's sort of the cleanser in the atmosphere, if you like. It reacts with methane, producing CO2 and water. I mean, the CO2 is not good, but the methane's at, you know, more of a part per billion level than a part per million level. So the CO2 produced when the OH- hydroxide breaks apart the methane molecule is not the biggest concern because it's at a lot lower level. And of course, the global warming potential of methane is enormous compared to that of CO2. You know, even on a 100-year average time scale, it's 34 times, going to 86 times over 20 years, and probably 150 to 200 times more powerful than the CO2 molecule on a few-year time scale, which is the time scale that we should really be concerned about.
All right. Well, Paul, we're starting to run out of time for what I have this week. I've got two quick questions for you. And the first one is that what if the developing ecological reality becomes so terrible, so unreal, that even the scientists who have the facts start to look like end-of-the-world freaks? Maybe my listeners will get tired of it and drift away. Maybe you'll be banned from teaching new climate science at university. Are we already getting there?
I don't think we're there yet. You know, it's possible. I mean, it's a concern, you know, that we go there. But, I mean, the scientific community is generally pretty reserved and pretty quiet. And the U.S. political situation, there's a march of scientists coming up, you know, in sort of the end of April in the U.S., and I think it's going to happen also in Canada. I mean, in Canada, this is not new to us. We had Harper for 8 years. We had muzzling of scientists. We had a lot of problems, and scientists marched in Ottawa. There was 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 scientists that marched a few years ago. And, you know, most of the people in the U.S. aren't even aware that happened in Canada. You know, now we're seeing the equivalent thing happening in the U.S. So, you know, I think scientists are starting to realize that they can't just continue to do their business as usual, you know, be quiet and in the labs and just publish papers. I mean, more and more of them are coming out to speak to the media. You know, this is a problem. We don't have much choice. I mean, we have to try to do what we can. The scope of the problem is enormous, but we have to take steps and see what we can do to arrest and slow down the problem. So there's obviously a lot of different stages of emotions that come into play. We have to recognize that and think of strategies to deal with. Think of deniers and some of the strategies that they might use. I mean, they say, first of all, they say climate change isn't happening. And then if they agree it's happening, they say, well, there's nothing we can do about it anyway. And then there's the people that think we're too far down the path of abrupt climate change and we can't do anything about it anyway. So the net result is you have the D&D crowd are saying we can't do anything about it. And I just can't accept that. We haven't even tried to do anything on a really serious basis about this. Sure, renewable energies are growing in leaps and bounds. This is one aspect, but this is not sufficient. You know, we need to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. We need to look at deploy ways to cool the Arctic so we don't get this complete loss of Greenland ice and methane coming up and all the rest of it. So we're not defenseless. We can't just roll over. So, you know, I'm very hopeful that once we actually decide that, hey, you know, we have a real huge problem here, once we collectively as a society decide this, then we do everything we can to back away from the precipice. And that hasn't happened. So how can we possibly think about, you know, throw up our hands and say we can't do anything when this hasn't even been, we haven't even reached the stage yet. And right. So it doesn't make any sense to me. But, you know, it's understandable that there's people that go from, you know, that experience this range of emotions, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'm with you, Paul. I'm freaked out, but I'm not giving up, and I'm going to keep doing this program until people wake up to some degree or start to do something, and I think we will eventually. We've been talking with climate scientist Paul Beckwith. He's a generalist, really. He studies the big picture. He's an educator by day at the University of Ottawa, and he's a public educator all the time, providing science for the masses on YouTube. You can find all this at paulbeckwith.net. I'll put links to the science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. And stay tuned for some in-depth interviews with some of those scientists. Paul Beckwith, I always appreciate your visits. Thank you for spending your valuable time with us.
Well, thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world. I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.